is when you'd like to look around and see if you can find a back door. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Onan family groups.
Hi,
I'm looking for Clancy. Probably taking a nap. I shouldn't have said that because he's got mic time last. I'm powerless. I'm powerless over people and over places and over things. And because of the program, I can make this admission without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found their sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. Ours is a fellowship that shares. But I feel strongly that we should share our recovery, not our sickness. And that's why these gatherings on the weekends that we call conventions or conferences or roundups or festivals, whatever we call them, these are a showcase of recovery. I think it's very hard to see growth within ourselves, but we can see it in other people. And these AA people just delight me. You know, they love without expectancy. They get together at these things, you know, the big ones, the internationals, and they pound each other on the back. They're just so tickled to see each other. Everybody, as Chuck Hank Chamberlain used to say, everybody's talking and nobody's listening. And then somebody else comes in back there and they stop right in mid-sentence and they say, look, there's old George. And he's still sober. They don't even expect each other to stay sober. And I'm delighted to be here to help you this weekend. Just delighted. I regret to say that my Bill could not come along. He had to go to the hospital last Monday to have some testing done. I talked to him this morning and they had released him. Now I have to say this slowly because I'm not used to medical terms, but Bill's diagnosis is diverticulitis. Did I get it all out? Anyway, he hasn't had a bite to eat except liquid since last Monday morning, and so I said to him, did the doctor give you a special diet? And he said, no, I had barbecue last night. And I said, please, Bill, try to stick to soup till I get home. But he insisted on me coming. It would have been kind of bad for me to call June last Monday and say, I'm sorry, but I can't make it. And Bill says that I need to come to these things. They are my energizers. So here I am, and I'm very grateful to be here. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. I refuse to be called an old-timer. And it's been my pleasure and great privilege for a large number of years now to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've learned about people. Every one of you here this afternoon are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. Nowhere at all. I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but this isn't the truth. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive, fatal illness that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers before our lifetime were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to alcoholics, prayed over them, had them sign pledges, and when these things failed, they damned their souls to hell. Men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students of that time, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed. There was no cure. So there was only one other thing we knew to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. And the longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when we finally released you. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it, to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said, "John's a good man when he's sober." And to repeat this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled by the behavior of the families of alcoholics. They could understand the alcoholic when he wrecked cars and did ridiculous things, wore lampshades on his head and things like that. They could understand it because they had been drinking. But they could not understand us. Law, no. They couldn't understand why we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. Of course, they almost killed us with pity. Ooh. We don't need pity. We need understanding. They gave us nice, shiny halos to wear, and we accepted them quite willingly. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called self-righteousness. Did you ever notice that word doesn't even taste good? It doesn't. They couldn't understand the families of alcoholics. There were some people that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. And then there were other people who thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. Mother used to say, "God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill." And Mother was right. Because God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. Then a little further along, the professionals got involved. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I work on the perimeter of professionals for a large number of years, but this is just what happened. These were the people who put the labels on us. they seemed to think that we were masochistic. Now, that's a 12-cylinder word that means you like to suffer. And I guess it depends on which side you're on. But these were the people who labeled us. Aggravating influences, we were called. Disturbing factors. And then they took the wraps off and they called us Suffering Susie. Wavering Winifred. Faltering Francis. Couldn't do a thing without Butis. But the thing that puzzled them most of all, now every one of you, I believe, knows what an alcoholic is, don't you? They're sorry, no account, low down people who never draw a sober breath, never do a day's work, and they don't support their families. You know that. But these people that were doing these innumerable studies on the personality of an alcoholic, whatever that is, and their families, were completely baffled when they discovered that some very brilliant people, some very talented people, were alcoholic. And they couldn't fit them into those little square holes and the round pegs and all of those things. So I did some research on these folks. And I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He'd conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he couldn't conquer his compulsion to drink. And he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music. But Stephen Foster was an alcoholic, a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. They found Stephen Foster sick unto death on the New York Bowery. And when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents, one penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair, but the love of his wife couldn't stop him from drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories. And he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of an alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room, just like a lot of you did. You saw the bottle change the man you love, or it could have been your wife, into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history says very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe I know to some degree the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. How'd you like your history lesson? My Al-Anon friends give me a hard time about that. They say, why in the name of conscience, Arbus, do you feel like it's necessary every time you get a whack at one of those microphones to give us a history lesson? And, of course, I have a reason. I can't tell jokes. I forget the punchline. No, that isn't the reason at all. I tell you these things to point out the contrast that I've described to you a few minutes ago, to explain to you that the very self-same people who were so completely baffled before the advent of AA are doing a great deal about the problem of alcoholism at this point in time. It is now possible to get an alcoholic in a hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This wasn't true when alcoholism reared its ugly head in mine and Bill's life. You couldn't get an alcoholic in the hospital, not unless a doctor was willing to make a false diagnosis and call it something else. You just couldn't get him in the hospital. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too. And so they send them to AA for treatment, and they send their families to us so they can get well too. And the National Council, of course, on Alcoholism has done a yeoman's job teaching the public that alcoholism is a treatable illness and that alcoholics need help and that they deserve it. And did you notice it's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and not find an article on alcoholism? I was amazed last year the National Geographic ran an article on alcoholism, and you know, that's a prestigious magazine. They don't just publish junk. But it's almost impossible not to learn about it anytime you read anything at all. It seems to me that it's become the in thing to have an alcoholic in your family. Now, if you don't have one, I strongly suggest that you go out and borrow one. Don't marry them. They're the handiest things you'll ever have. They're as handy as a pocket on a shirt. Anything that goes wrong, anything at all that goes wrong, you can blame it on the alcoholic. I'd have been happy a few years back to share some with you. I was overstocked. And please, again, don't misunderstand me. These dear people in the professions are doing everything they can about alcoholism with the knowledge that they have to work with. But the truth of the matter is, and I regret to report this to you this afternoon, they are not getting the job done. Had you noticed that? They're not getting the job done because they don't know all there is to know about alcoholism. But right this minute, I'm looking at a room full of experts. You're the ones who know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms. You know the progression. You know about slips in AA. You know about the alibi system. You know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of you, bless your heart, have lived through the terrors of DTs. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do. A job for you and for me. And I learned that a long time ago. You see, when I came into this outfit before we had an outfit. I really did. I predate Al-Anon. When I got here, we simply called our fellowship, small as it was, the family groups. Then in 1951, when we got some attention and got a name, called ourselves Al-Anon family groups. Al-Anon is a contraction of the words Alcoholics Anonymous. We took the first syllable out of Alcoholics and the first syllable of Anonymous and became Al-Anon family groups. Please do not forget to put the hyphen in the name. But this is how we got a name. When I came here, we had 50 groups in the whole world. I think now we have between 35 and 40,000 groups in the world, and I've been privileged to watch this society evolve, and it's been the most fascinating thing in my life. I wouldn't have missed it for the world, and I wouldn't do it again for $1 million. When I came here, we didn't have any literature. Now we could paper this meeting hall and maybe the corridor out there with the pamphlets that we published. We've forgotten our primary purpose, I think, and turned into a publishing house. I think we have an unlimited printing budget. We didn't have 12 hardback books when I came here. We didn't have any literature at all. We didn't have a program to live by. But worse than that, we didn't have a purpose to live for. Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And the dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together were visionaries. They knew that in time, the families of alcoholics would become aware of this necessity, and so when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us. Because they included in that book two chapters just for us. One of those chapters is entitled Two Wives. Now that is not intended to be a put-down for the fine men that we have in the Al-Anon family groups. Not at all. The fact of the matter is that when that book was written, there were no women in AA, so they addressed that chapter to wives. The groups up in Canada used to call their groups the wives' groups. The other chapter, of course, as you well know, is entitled To the Family Afterwards. And down in my part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, we took a paragraph from that chapter and we made of it a preamble that we used to open our meetings. They've asked me to start collecting things for our archives in West Texas, and I'm just hoping against hope that one of those preambles will surface. The copies that I had blew away in 1979 with a little thing called a tornado. Blew a lot of things out of our lives, but I'm hoping against hope that one of those preambles will surface. This is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem, and we feel that each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. You know, that's powerful stuff. As far as I'm concerned, we don't have a piece of literature yet that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility is to the families of alcoholics. And we don't have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me how I can show my gratitude for the recovery in my family and for the good things that recovery has brought to us. Now, we've got a little thing going around in our fellowship that says under no circumstances should Al-Anon members take a big book or a book, Alcoholics Anonymous, into a meeting. I think it's banned in Boston. And I'm going to say some things, as June said, might ruffle some people's feelings, and it won't be a new experience. I require the people that I sponsor to study the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous or get themselves another sponsor. Now, when all of this thing about developing literature started, we developed the literature for Al-Anon on the assumption, which is always a mistake, that you had first studied the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now please think with me. Think with me back to the late 40s and the early 50s when there weren't very many AAs around. And remember, we didn't have anything going for us except the dubious permission of these people who were very new in AA to come to their clubhouses while they had a meeting. And that's what we did. We met in wide hallways and dirty little kitchens. Remember that place down in Abilene, Neva? God, we met in those places and we talked. Now, you know very well what we talked about. It was a kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those meetings. I didn't live with the sorry man. I still don't. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. And I get pretty defensive about those those early meetings. To be sure, there were nothing more than gossip sessions. But I have to remind you people in Al-Anon that if we had not been there then, you wouldn't be here now. So don't get critical. And so I went to those people in AA. Took Bill 6 years to make 1 year sobriety. And those AA people were very supportive of me. And I went to them and I said, I don't understand this. And this is out of character. Bill's a good man. Why does he tell me lies? Why can't I depend on him? Bill lied. And he broke promises. And he stole people's money. Of course, he said it was advance on commission, but he was stealing company money. And Bill isn't a thief, and Bill isn't a liar. And I couldn't understand that. And they said to me, read this book, Arbutus. You can read the personal stories if you like, but concentrate on the first 164 pages. It will explain the nature of the illness that Bill has. And then you'll understand the behavior. God, that's what I was looking for. And they went on to say, these pages will teach you the philosophy that you need for your own recovery. What more can you want? That's exactly what I was looking for, to understand the behavior and to learn something to do about it. You bet. Now, I want you to know that we watched those fellas very carefully. We saw people go to those scroungy little old meeting places, people that had never been able to draw a sober breath. And they went down there, and they talked to each other, and they never took another drink. And that impressed the hell out of us. This fulfilled my need. I think that's how I want to say it. And I can't understand why anybody is reluctant. I've been rereading the book that they put together, the AA people put together a few years back called As Bill Sees It. It's a reprint of much of the things that he wrote in other publications, except for the personal letters that they reprinted. And Nell Wing, bless her heart, he carried on a voluminous correspondence, and Nell was smart enough to keep copies of those letters. And he says more than once, you know, let's don't let any base be uncovered. Let's get all the information we can from whatever source and put it together for your own recovery. So this is what I did. This is what I did, and this is what I insist on people that I sponsor doing, because I can't work with people unless they follow the same outline that was given to me. I know it isn't the only way to find recovery, but you all kind of put me on a spot when you ask me to come up to Illinois or anywhere else. You say to me, in essence, tell me how you got well. And I got well by reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then if you notice, that outline in the big book is pretty concise and brief. And then Bill Wilson, bless his heart, wrote another book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And in that book, he talks about feelings. He tells you what will happen if you don't get rid of your resentments. He tells you what will happen if you continue to be suspicious and jealous. And God, I've got a streak of jealousy down my backbone as wide as both of my hands. I didn't like it when that boy of mine came into this fellowship. Good looking, smart. And those little gals that cuddle up to him. I didn't like it. I didn't like it a bit. He's mine. And I don't share him with nobody. I know this is a program that shares, but I'll share anything with you. And Bill Wilson writes in that book what will happen if you don't rid yourself of those suspicions and those jealousies. And so I use this book when we have step study meetings. And if that offends you, I don't care a bit. I'm going home in the morning and you all can fight out among yourselves. We share with you our experience, strength, and hope. And that's what you asked me to come up here and do. I'm sure you was. And I've attended my first open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. I didn't want to go to that meeting. My Bill, as I told you a minute ago, took 6 years to make his first year of sobriety. He learned about AA in Fort Worth, Texas, but he couldn't accept the second half of the first step, and he couldn't stay sober. And I didn't have very much confidence in my young husband's sobriety. And the only reason I went to that meeting is because I'd put myself under an obligation to a very lovely lady who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't picked up on the accent yet, I'll tell you that I'm a hillbilly from the hills of North Carolina. And hillbillies don't like to be obliged. Hillbillies don't like to lose. We're not reluctant to get an equalizer, but we don't fail. And so I went to that meeting because I'd put myself under an obligation to Marguerite. And it was, as I said, an open meeting. There was about 150 people there. And I drink an awful lot of coffee, as some of you have noticed. And after the meeting started, a very lovely lady that I later learned was AA leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. What she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed with her question. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust teetotalers, but I have a friend down in Wichita Falls, Texas, that never tasted liquor in her life. She's a real teetotaler, and I trust Mildred with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was embarrassed to death, and she answered the question. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man. He worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry, who taught me to sing Irish folk songs, who had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father was absolutely and totally insane when he drank liquor. And he hurt my mother. He hurt my mother emotionally, and he hurt her physically. And mother never could understand when her jaw was broken that dad had just intended to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. She couldn't understand that. And I'm quite sure I couldn't have understood it. My father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Dad was one of those people who never found this program. He used to come to Texas, and he'd go to AA meetings with us. He used to go to meetings out on Butternut Street, and I don't think you ever met Dad. And we'd come home from those meetings, and he would say to Bill and me, "How do you get the want to? How do you get the want to?" Dad couldn't find the want to, and he couldn't stay simple. And for many years after I found the courage in this program to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I closed every day of my life with one special prayer. "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I cannot tell you why that's such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. My father died in 1965. He had throat cancer. He did not die drunk. And when my brother Mike called to tell me that Dad had a terminal illness, he said to me, "We're going to have to pray extra hard for Dad Arbus. He isn't going to make it." And I said, "No. No." Now, you know very well that I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to make it impossible for my dad to even have a drink of water. You know I didn't. I prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them, because my dad's all right. My dad doesn't have to drink anymore, and mother doesn't hate him any longer. I tell you these things that you may know that I've always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. Because I know about you alcoholics. I know that of all the things you love your families most. Of this I am convinced. You love your families most. Even when you tear us down over and over and over again, you love your families most. And I want you to know that when I married Bill O'Neill, I wasn't concerned with his drinking. Father Martin says you can't identify an alcoholic except by the ones that you know. And Bill wasn't hallucinating drunk. Bill was not insane when he drank. Bill was a life of the party drunk. He crashed debutante's parties and taught the chaperones to put your little foot. He wasn't like Dad at all, and I was not concerned. I drank with Bill. Good Lord of mercy. It was very important in our generation that you have fun. I heard an AA lady say she had so much fun it liked to kill her. And that's about what happened to Bill and me. We got drunk everywhere we went. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States, and we got drunk in Chicago, St. Louis, San Antonio, San Francisco, anywhere we went, we got drunk. I don't remember that we were ever in Champaign, Illinois, but if we'd been here, we'd have been drunk. But in 1940, two things happened to make Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. I was watching the troop movements in Europe and later in the South Pacific, and I quit drinking with Bill. We had our second child the next year, and Bill wasn't there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, but she didn't get to meet her dad till Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the maternity ward in a Catholic hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, because he wanted to teach the head of the maternity ward the Texas stomp, and the good sister didn't want to dance. And he left the hospital at the insistence of the doctors and with the help of two big burly orderlies, and sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop, tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. Our only son was born the next year, and I know that this is a dreary recitation for you to listen to, but you see, my brothers went into the service, and my sisters went into the defense plants, and I had to stay home and keep up production. But when our only son was born, something went wrong in the delivery room, and they needed Bill. And they couldn't find Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that they'd find Bill in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which one. And my friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. And I believe they believe that. But I also believe that I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife. When she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. The crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her daddy, and you can't find her daddy. I want my daddy. And you can't find her daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. Our son was a frail little boy. My doctors told us he'd never walk. And I was overwhelmed with the strongest sense of guilt that I've ever felt in my life because I manipulated that pregnancy. I knew that Bill wanted a little boy. I guess every man wants a son. And I gave him a son who couldn't walk. And that started an odyssey for me that took me to many hospitals in many states across these United States to try to find a doctor that'd make my boy walk. When Luther was 3 months old, I learned I was pregnant again. We were living down in Knoxville, Tennessee, about the time that they brought that atomic energy plant in. And of course, the alcoholism had progressed. And Bill changed jobs pretty often. He had personality clashes with the people he worked for. And he had a good job down in Knoxville. He worked for Holland Furnace Company, a straight salary and commission. And it was not at all unusual for Bill to make $700 or $800 each week. And that was a lot of money in the early 40s. We were evicted from a furnished house in Knoxville, Tennessee, that rented for $50 a month. And I couldn't find another place in Knoxville. So I had to go up into Kentucky, a little town called Middleton. And I found a garage apartment up there. Now, please remember, I'm expecting my fourth child any minute. And the arrangements that I'd made in Knoxville had to be canceled because I'm not in Knoxville anymore. I'm 70 miles up into Kentucky. And I checked in at the local hospital there to learn that I wasn't eligible to go there to be delivered of my child because that hospital was for the exclusive use of the coal miners that lived in that area. And about the time that I made this brilliant discovery, they carried Bill home. Now, they'd carried him home before. But this time his leg was broken. He had an argument with his boss, and Bill never won a fight in his life. He must have felt 10 foot tall when he was drinking because he'd just get the bejabers beat out of him. They carried him home, and they did agree to put a cast on his leg in the emergency room. And I got on a Greyhound bus. Luther can't walk. Peggy is 3 years old.
Nancy is 2. Luther's a year old and he can't walk. And I'm expecting my 4th child any minute. And we got on the Greyhound bus to go back to Cincinnati, Ohio. Mother didn't know I was pregnant. I think she told her friends at least 2 of my children were premature, but they were not. I don't know who was most relieved when we got to Cincinnati, me or the bus driver. And I go out to Mother's neighborhood. She lives in an exclusive district, an apartment where they don't have children. And it didn't have an elevator. So I go upstairs with Luther in my arms and knock on the door. And she, Mother was only 12 years older than my Bill, and God, she hated him. She hated him with a purple passion. After he got an AA, she thought she hatched him. But she opened the door and almost dropped dead, and I said, Mother, would you please go downstairs and help Bill? And she said, what is the matter with him? Is he drunk? And I said, no, ma'am, his leg's broken. So she put us down on the couch, and you all know those lectures that we get. You know, and she said, of all my children, RBS, you are undoubtedly the most brilliant child I have, but it takes a damn genius to get in a mess like this. And our little Teresa was born in the Salvation Army in the charity ward. I don't like to tell this story. Bill says I have to because it's real good for you high-bottom drunks. And this didn't take 10,000 years to happen. This was fast. Bill hit the skids and he was gone. And again, the things that I'll wear to my grave, the emotional scars that I'll wear to my grave came from those experiences when I was served with those eviction notices. And please believe me, that was not the last one that I was to see. And each time that they served those eviction notices, I thought I saw the look of pity and disgust on the faces of those who served them. And when I had to make application to get into that hospital, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters, as if I couldn't read, husband is a drunkard. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I'm not sure that the people in Texas appreciate this part of my story. I don't think that I'll ever be able to describe what it means to a hillbilly to accept charity. But you go to a welfare agency to feed your children. Don't think you won't. And you'll go to a welfare agency to get treatment for your young son. Oh, yes, you will. And I like to starve to death because I couldn't eat the food. I hope to God I never see another bowl of spaghetti. Spaghetti's cheap. And I almost starved to death because I couldn't swallow the food. And I want you to know that when I came to the state of Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time. My Bill lost his left eye as the result of drinking. And he couldn't stop drinking. My Bill lost his left arm as a result of drinking. And he couldn't stop drinking. I watched this boy lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep. I watched him lose the affection of his family. I watched him lose the respect of the people he worked for. I watched him lose his self-respect, and I'll never forget the day that Bill looked up at me and said, honey, why don't you take the kids and go? I'm no damn good. I watched him lose everything that he wanted to keep, and I wanted to help him, and I couldn't. I'm going to say something directly to you people and you alcoholics. I've heard you through the years stand at podiums like this and say, a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I've worked with alcoholic women until my hair and my skin reeked with the odor of formaldehyde. That used to be what they used to sober up the the people who were drinking too much. I've worked with these people until my skin and my hair reeked with this nauseous odor and gone home, grateful in the knowledge that but for the grace of God, somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me by coffee to send my own children to school. I've held an alcoholic in my arms through the long nights when he was in convulsions, scared to death that he wouldn't live till morning. Scared to death that if he did live, there wouldn't be any sanity left. I didn't know which one of those eyes was artificial. And I've had my own father beat me black and blue, killing spiders that only he could see. And my father loved me. I was his firstborn. I'm not talking about child abuse. I'm talking about this insanity that comes with alcoholism. I know what I'm talking about. We wanted to help you, but we couldn't help you because you wouldn't let us. It seemed to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we could see you, and we could hear you. We're not calloused, insensitive people. We know the mental anguish you endure. We know the physical torture. The feeling I'm trying to describe is the feeling that those of you who are parents will understand. It's the feeling you have when you tend a sick child. The baby's burning up with fever and it cries and you want to help. But you can't help because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt. And we couldn't help you. But there's people very likely in this room who wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for somebody like me. And I want you to remember that the next time that you indict an Al-Anon member. You know, just being married to an alcoholic does not make you a member of the Al-Anon family groups. Don't you ever think it does. You got to do a little bit more. You have to make an honest effort to practice the principles of this program that you gave to us. You've got to go to meetings regularly. You've got to write that four-step inventory. You've got to get a sponsor. And you've got to sponsor people. And you've got to be willing to get up any time of the day or night and go help a little gal that's sweating it out in a dirty bathrobe. And go inside of her house and put your arms around her and say, "My name is Arbutus O'Neill. I'm a member of the Al-Anon family groups and I came to help you." That's an Al-Anon member. When I went to Texas in 1944, I went there with the illusion that Bill's family would be supportive of him. They didn't understand, and please, this is not an indictment. They didn't understand. They thought that anybody that married a girl from North Carolina, where they make all of that bourbon and make blow all those cigarettes, couldn't help but be an alcoholic. He certainly didn't drink too much when he lived at home. He was one of those Southern Baptists. So I failed to find the support that I went to Texas to find. But I did find something else. I found a group of people. These people called themselves members of AA. And when I came, when I found these people, I was totally, totally and utterly destitute in mind and body. And these people tried to help me. And I never shall forget the first AA member I ever talked to. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program. I didn't know anything else to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours, please, sir? That's for the families, that's for the wives and children of alcoholics." And he couldn't answer the question. Nobody had ever asked him that before. And he said to me, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. Still think he was wrong. At that moment, I could not wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was so nervous I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And this good member of AA said, "You do not have a problem." And I believe it was that self same cold November afternoon when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we wound up, that I made up my mind that I'd find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me, because then I met some more people. Now, this was a weird group of non-alcoholics who found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of the recovery program to preserve their stability and to restore them to sanity. These people entertained the same fears as does the alcoholic. These people cultivated the same self-pity and developed the same resentments as does the alcoholic. They even developed the same characteristics as does the alcoholic. There was only one difference. They did not have the allergy to booze, and this was the most revolting development of all, because this meant they had to take their punishment standing up, cold sober. And there's not an alcoholic in the world that can do it. Not without help, you can't. And we couldn't either. We only thought we could. You see, back in those days, we didn't have thousands and thousands and thousands of case histories. Now we do. And we were pretty smug. We said, well, after all, we don't show the physical and mental manifestations of this illness. Don't we? Don't we now? I'm hearing stories all the time about people in the on family groups that are winding up on the back wards of mental institutions. Going over to Alabama a few months back and called a friend of mine in Monroe, Louisiana. We didn't have time to go by her house, so we stopped for coffee and I called her. And she didn't sound very good. And I said, you don't sound good, Theresa. Have you been sick? And she said, I'm just home from the hospital, Arbutus. I had a major heart attack. Heart attacks are caused by stress, the doctors say. Pretty little girl who made it possible for me to go down to New Orleans to the International, because she had a motor home and I could come up with the money to pay part of the gasoline bill. 52 years old. Died on an operating table in Dallas, Texas. Peptic ulcers. Ulcers are caused by stress, the doctors say. And can you all tell me anything that is more stressful than living with an alcoholic, drunk or sober? No way. These jokers live in the fast lane. They want everything done just right. And yesterday, Mother used to say to me, you may not live very long, Arbutus, but you'll never be bored. And I never have. I never have. And when I found these strange people, I was, Ola. I had no faith in God. I had no confidence in my husband's sobriety. And I couldn't trust people. People do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. Oh, I believe there was a God, you know, creator of the universe, if you please, who changed the seasons and painted your trees bright orange and red, who turns the days into nights and hung up the stars to make it pretty for us. I believe those things, but I had no concept of a personal contact with God, none at all. And God knew why I couldn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for the things that I did. And I was not responsible for the things that I said. And if there's an Al-Anon member in this room who looked me in the eye and say she's never had an emotional blackout, I'm going to say she'll fib about other things. I was not responsible. And I didn't come here to get Bill sober. I came here because our four children were scared to death of me. I came here because my Bill was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my children to be afraid of me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not a child abuser. They were scared to death of my disapproval. I punished them unmercifully if they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, and I insisted on white tablecloth. They were afraid to bring home their grade card if they made a C, because I would not tolerate failure. I would say to them, anybody can be average. Failure had been bred out of me, and I would not tolerate in my children. And I didn't want Bill to be afraid of me or ashamed of me. But they were writing some articles in the ladies' magazines in the late 40s about something they called group therapy in the field of mental health. And that's what I thought the family groups were. In a sense, that's what they were. And so I went to that grubby little clubhouse down in Abilene, Texas, where there was seven ladies sitting around a lazy daisy to change their fingernail polish, and they played poker when they got their nails finished. And they had a preamble that incorporated the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights, and the marriage ceremony. And so I fell in with that bunch, and it scared me to death. I didn't go back to any meetings. And Bill was anxious about it. He said, you really need to go to those meetings, Arbus. And I said, no way. Those people are sick, and I don't want to get like that. But then we got a transplant from the state of California who had gone to meetings with Elsa Chamberlain, who died a couple of weeks back. And to say she turned that group around was an understatement. And she put my nose down those 12 steps, and I had the distinct feeling that if I didn't take those steps, I'd never come up for air. And I took them for the worst possible motive. I was going to slap that paper down in front of that gray-eyed sponsor and say, I took these blasted things, and I was going to get an A-plus up in the corner. I had to have surgery recently, and I'd forgotten my blood type, and my medical records got blown away, too. And so I said, please type my blood while I'm here. It came back A-positive. Kid said, you didn't have a chance, Mother. You were born a high achiever. But I was going to slap that paper down and say I took these things and they didn't work. And they did. Now, I'd like to be able to tell you that overnight I became a wise and wonderful woman, but that obviously is not the truth. But I will tell you that my life changed. The first thing that I could notice was that the children could relax around me. They became so relaxed they sassed me. And then a little later, I became aware of the fact that once again, Bill was proud of me. And that's important to those of us who love alcoholics. Elsa Chamberlain explained that. Now, I've already described to you what an alcoholic is. Would you not agree that an alcoholic is just about as low down on the social totem pole as you can get? And then you rejected us. So that's a real sick need for approval, as Elsa used to say, that all of us have. And we don't need very much of it. Just occasionally tell us that we did a good job, or that we look nice, we smell good, anything, just a little. But I needed that approval, and I was grateful for it. And then I give my friends in Texas a hard time. I made friends, of course, right in my own little group. And then I'm the only delegate that Texas ever had in the only Al-Anon family group delegate that Texas ever had. When my panel was over, they had divided our state into two areas, and it took two people to do my job. And I never let them forget it. And I went to New York, and I was privileged to work with Lois and to meet Bill Wilson. Oh, God, I'm grateful for those things. And then I met delegates from the rest of the part of the country. I remember your first Illinois delegate. Her name was Marie Odegaard. And then I knew I had friends all over the world. And some of you told me you liked me, and then I could belong to the human race. You see, I never belonged anywhere at all. I grew up in construction camps. Grandfather owned the business, and Dad took the out-of-state contracts, and we traveled with him. I didn't go to one school more than one semester till I was high school age. Never belonged to a school system. You don't go to church when you don't believe in God. And now I belong to the greatest thing in the world. I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. And have you noticed there's a little difference in the Al-Anon people and the AA people? There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. Did you know that? No quitters. I don't know what happens to them, bless their heart, but they don't make it in Al-Anon. We don't quit hoping that the man we married will come home again. We know he's lost down in the bottom of a bottle. And we don't want to change him. We just want the man we married to come home again. And we don't quit hoping. Hope burns low at times, but we don't quit hoping. And we don't quit helping the alcoholic. Our methods get a little drastic, but we don't quit helping you. We'll help you to death. But more important, we don't quit loving the alcoholic. There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family group. And I took the principles of this program and reared those four children. And I'd stand behind podiums like this and say, I'll put my four up against any four in the world. And I still will. And I was filled with an urgency that I didn't understand. I felt it vitally necessary to learn everything I could about alcoholism and about the structure of our fellowship. And I've been guilty of standing at podiums like this and say, if there has been anything written about alcoholism that I have not read, it's been printed in the last 24 hours, and that was almost the truth. And I didn't, again, the motive was bad. I didn't understand it for a long time. Excuse me. I know now, of course, what I was trying to do was create an environment that would prevent alcoholism. It killed my father. It disabled my husband. And I was not going to have it threaten my children. And I have to report to you this afternoon that two of our children are members of AA. Nancy Dale had 12 years of sobriety last September, or this last month. Fourth day of September, and Luther will be sober 12 years St. Valentine's Day. I forgot one very important thing called body chemistry, but I tried. The little doctor that put Luther in my lap when he was 10 days old said to me, take him home, Mrs. O'Neill, and enjoy him, because you can't keep him. And I've already told you how I made the tour of the crippled children's hospitals in these United States. A year ago in July, Luther had a massive heart attack. He'd been out in the archery range and came in, and he had some chest pains, but I guess those things kind of stretch your muscles. He wasn't concerned about it, but his wife was. And she got him into the emergency ward, and he had his heart attack in the hospital. My kid's not stupid. They sent him over to the Humana Hospital in Abilene, Texas, and did that surgery that when they put the balloon to open the blockage. And when they tested his blood to do the surgery, they learned he had diabetes. He'd gotten a physical every year since he's been working, and he'd never shown. They thought it was not serious enough to give him insulin, but it could not be corrected with a special diet, so they gave him a oral medication and sent him home. He reacted to the medication, had to be put on a respirator for 5 days. I'll swear it was 1,000 years. And the surgery collapsed, and they did it the second time and killed his heart. He's not eligible for a transplant. And we didn't expect to bring him home from the hospital. But he's lived a year. Didn't have a group in the little town where he lives, so he started one. He's teaching us truly what it means by one day at a time. And I've said to you, some of you pretty girls this weekend, I don't have troubles anymore. And I don't have problems. And truly I don't. By the grace of God in this program, I have experiences. And some of them are exceedingly uncomfortable and tragic and unhappy. And I heard you. I thought, You told me that if I would accept these things, that if it was a fact that I must accept it, and if it was a feeling that I must change it. And I listened to you very carefully. But what I heard you say was, if you accept these things, you'll be happy. That is not what you said. If you accept these things, it will be easy. That is not what you said. And so I've taken a refresher course in acceptance. And this thing with Bill is partially compounded by his anxiety about Luther. And he won't admit it. My Bill is almost 6 foot tall, and he weighs 123 pounds. And the thing I'm saying to you is, the principles of this program will help you resolve any living problem you will ever have. And I can attest to that because I've tried it. When I got here, I didn't know this program would work for me. I hoped it would. None of us knew that it would work for those of us who are not alcoholic. We hoped it would. And so we tried it. And it worked. And then we tested it. We talked among ourselves and we said, do you suppose that people who don't even speak English could use this program? And so we translate our literature into other languages, and you can go to Japan or Finland and go to an Al-Anon meeting and read the same literature that you're reading over here wherever you meet. So we tried it, and we tested it, and we proved it. And then we put it in a pretty package for you, and we tied it up with a nice red ribbon, and we put it on a silver platter, and we gave it to you. Now, what you do with it is none of my business. But I'd like you to remember that the formation of this fellowship took the blood and sweat and tears of a lot of people. People like Lois Wilson and Elsa Chamberlain and Margaret Doherty and dozens and dozens and dozens of more. And it belongs to you. It is your heritage. But my grandchildren might need that program. And when you hand it over to them, I want you to hand it over to them just exactly like it was when you got it, or I will hold you responsible. Every time I close the meeting, I close it in the same way, and that boy's looking anxious. I remind you that the principles of this program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And I remind you that you're the only people in the world who are so quite uniquely qualified to carry this message. And I remind you that maybe out here in the football stadium, well, law knows out in the football stadium this afternoon, there are drunken men and women who will die, just as Stephen Foster died, in drunken ignorance, never knowing they're alcoholic if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids in your pretty town, and down in Brownwood, Texas, and everywhere that I know, who are afraid for their dad to come home tonight. Or it could be their mother. Saturday nights were the worst of all, remember? And these kids will grow up with a deformed personality if we fail to carry this message. And there's men and women in this beautiful city and in my city who won't have the courage to live one more day with an alcoholic. And they'll break up their homes if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.